I arrived to Iraq on the 20th of June 2004 at the Baghdad International Airport, and we took a convoy ride from the airport to Abu Ghraib, where I would be stationed as an interrogator. And the scandal of Abu Ghraib, the abuse scandal, had already broken in the U.S. media, so I knew what I was getting into. I knew what was happening there. The motivation that I had was simply gain your sergeant stripes, gain some leadership, and hold people accountable. Be a force of restraint and of justice in this place.
The man sitting before me is nothing like what I had imagined. Joshua Castile, 28. A fair-haired, boyish-looking man. A tall, lean frame, wire-rimmed glasses, and crisp goatee. Joshua does not look like the Army interrogator I came to interview in this hotel in Iowa City. He looks every inch the playwriting student he is today. But I won't ask him about that. I want to know about his time as an interrogator at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison on the outskirts of Baghdad. About what led a patriotic reservist from Iowa to the depths of a moral quagmire. One that would lead him to doubt both his nation and himself.
I was raised as a non-denominational evangelical Christian. When I was about 2.5, probably, I went to one of the local vacation Bible schools, and you know, we would talk about the Israelites going through the desert and talk about Jesus and Noah's Ark, and the woman who was hosting asked who wanted to meet Jesus, and it was just kind of a no-brainer. It was like, well, of course I want to meet Jesus. I always had this sense of presence of some kind of, I guess, you know, looking back, I guess I would describe it as being an awareness of divinity of sorts.
That awareness of divinity was strengthened and developed by his mother.
She taught me that doing the laundry was a prayerful event, that you're supposed to pray without ceasing, and that your everyday life is supposed to be a prayer offering, and your relationship with God from the very religious things to dirty socks.
Service to God, and later, service to country. Two missions in life that were in fact one, an ideal that Joshua zealously pursued.
It was actually an ethical imperative that Christians be engaged in civil service in order to kind of stop the flow of secularism and to reclaim the country to its Christian origins. We need to be engaged as Christian civil leaders.
Even from a young age, Joshua knew he would serve his country by enlisting in the military.
My grandfather fought in World War II, Korea and Vietnam. My dad was an Army captain. My aunt was in the Army as well. I grew up in, I guess, a mythology of the armed services. And I decided to enlist in the Army Reserves at the age of 17 in February of 1997.
But during his reservist training, he realized that his one mission had two masters, God and country, and Joshua felt them lock horns for the first time. It would happen again.
My first moral obstacle in combat training as a 17-year-old was going out onto the bayonet assault course, and it's an incredibly storied tradition that when you go to the bayonet assault course for your training, all the soldiers are rallied into bleachers, and the drill sergeant comes out in front and he says, "What's the spirit of the bayonet?" And you say, "Kill, kill, kill without mercy, sergeant." And then he says, "What makes the green grass grow?" And you say, "Blood, blood, bright red blood, sergeant."
Joshua's internal struggle began.
And I didn't really question it a whole lot, but if drill sergeants weren't looking, I wouldn't say the words. No one is supposed to like violence, but the whole idea is that sometimes it's necessary. So I focused my mind and attention on duties and skill in my profession. When I came back to high school, you know, there was a difference in me, certainly, and my parents observed it as well. You know, I'd really gone through a test, a rite of passage of sorts, and I really began to see myself in a different way, which I think is one of the one of the great brilliant aspects of military training and life in the military. And I went to prom my senior year of high school wearing my dress blues. And then I went off to West Point.
West Point, the oldest and arguably most prestigious military academy in the United States.
Well, I left before the 9 months was up. And there were plenty of things to be inspired by, but what was both intriguing to me and disconcerting was the way that I responded to this uniformity of behavior. Everyone is clear about their purpose, about the overall purpose of the institution. And on the one hand, that's very invigorating, because how many times in one's life do you have that kind of clarity?
The seeds of doubt planted early on started to grow.
I found myself constantly at odds with this clarity.
Joshua walked away from the military and entered the University of Iowa. 3 years later, he graduated with a degree in philosophy and literature.
And then 9/11 happened.
Still technically a member of the Iowa Reserves, Joshua prepared for the possibility that he'd be called upon to serve.
And I didn't have an ethical answer to what was going on. After the towers came down, I knew something had to be done. I simply rested on duty as being the determining factor on what I would do, that I had signed a contract, so it's time to live up to it. It's time to finish what you started. So I decided to go back in, and I decided to be trained as an Arabic linguist.
Growing up with the Old Testament gave Joshua an interest in the Arabic language. But the only job in the military that guarantees language training is interrogator training.
And I wasn't entirely thrilled with that, because I'd seen The Deer Hunter and Law and Order and Visions of the Swinging Lamp. But I thought to myself, perhaps it's better to have a person who is a little bit more ethically sensitive in those positions, so that things are done morally uprightly. My first experiences in the interrogator school were actually very encouraging, because they emphasized the Geneva Conventions and they emphasized the law of land warfare. And the easiest way to fail a mock interrogation is to cross those lines.
But then the training intensified and Joshua began to change.
I fell into the character of an accuser with great ease, of being able to take the evidence that's in front of me and then to build a case against the person. And the thing that was shocking to me was just how easy it was to slip into that character, to play that role. You know, things that I hadn't anticipated started happening, like, you know, profanities just start flowing out of my mouth. You really start to feel the rage associated to being an agent of justice. You are the right person. The person across from you is a criminal, is evil, and it's your job to acquire justice, to get the truth out of this person. And whether you're using a nice approach or a mean approach, you're right.
Then, with 2 years of training under his belt, Joshua was posted to Abu Ghraib.
The Abu Ghraib prison is a vast compound. It's huge. The perimeter looks like it's made out of sandstone. The entrance to the prison is a weaving back and forth between concrete slabs that are designed to prevent suicide trucks from being able to access the gate. Inside each interrogation room, it's a wooden room, approximately 5 feet by 8 feet, maybe 6.5 feet tall, with a two-way mirror on the far wall. You constantly had the smell of musty wood, the constant stale smell of the desert, and as well as the smell of the detainees, because the detainees usually didn't smell that nice.
5 days into his tour of duty, Joshua put his interrogation training to work.
Everything is used as an exploitative tactic. The textbook definition of interrogation is to exploit the greatest amount of intelligence in the least amount of time. And the role of the interrogator is to use whatever weaknesses a person may possess, whether it's love, hatred, guilt, shame, and you try to use that in order to push their buttons in such a way that they will tell you information. You're not allowed to threaten a person directly with death, but you can threaten a person with their own imagination over the possibility that, say, if they don't cooperate with you, they'll end up staying in jail, which means that they're not home to protect their families. So you'll say, I'll do everything in my power to offer your family protection, to maybe move them to a safer part of Iraq, knowing full well that you have no authority, you have no capacity to actually move their families, but you vaunt their own imagination over the possibility of the death of their families. You start realizing that things don't really work according to the way that you're trained. I was interrogating taxi drivers, young fathers, local laborers, imams, veterans of previous Iraqi wars. I had over 130 combat interrogations, and I can count on one hand the number of people I spoke to during that entire 7-month stay that were guilty of anything other than being Arab. These are the questions that I was asking. What do we do about these people who aren't threats to the coalition?
As the war raged on, Joshua looked for answers in the quiet refuge of the Abu Ghraib Chapel.
The Chapel of Abu Ghraib was probably 20 feet by 40 feet. It smelled like dusty concrete. The walls were cracked from wear and from mortar attacks. There was a wooden cross at the what would be the altar.
This makeshift chapel was housed in a former cafeteria. Joshua spent a lot of time here, his internal battle raging.
And I preferred going there at nights in order for it to be dark. Oftentimes, chaplains weren't able to make it because of security concerns, and so I would pray the Eucharistic liturgy in their absence. And I spent so much of my private time in prayer. It was a sanctuary for me. The more that I developed an intense prayer, routine in Iraq, the more perilous it became for me to comprehend what I was praying relative to what I was doing. I would take the body and blood of Christ into my mouth, and then I would go back into the interrogation room and use that same mouth with the detainees that I thought were innocent, and I would be praying things like the Magnificat, which talks about the elevation of the poor. And the downtrodden, feeding the hungry with good things while the rich are sent empty away. This promise to to persecuted Israel that God will fulfill their promises and raise up the downtrodden. While I was using my Eucharistically filled mouth to what I thought was terrorize poor people.
3 months into his posting, a suicide bomber tried to breach the prison entrance. Joshua was jolted from sleep by the sounds of Marines unleashing a massive counterattack.
Mark 19 automatic grenade launchers and M60 and 50 caliber machine guns. Unbelievable amount of firepower, which kept me alive.
The would-be bomber was killed.
And I went to pray the next morning, thinking about the violence that had been done on my behalf and thinking about the interrogations I was engaged in and thinking about my prayers. And I looked at my prayer book for probably an hour, and then I just set it down, I shaved, and I went to work. I began to interrogate in a different, more sedate, more perhaps cynical capacity.
Nearly 7 months into his posting to Abu Ghraib, Joshua readied himself for another round of interrogations. But on this day, Joshua wouldn't be interrogating taxi drivers or laborers. The man he would interrogate was a confessed jihadi.
He was 22 years old. He'd never fired a gun in his life. He'd been arrested 2 weeks after crossing the border into Iraq, which meant that he'd never even had the opportunity to join the Mujahideen to fight jihad against the coalition. He had been recruited by a Sunni cleric in Saudi Arabia, and he crossed the border into Iraq on foot and stayed in a safe house in the industrial district in Fallujah, which was an area controlled by Omar Hadid, who was the chief lieutenant at the time of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. He was completely perplexing because if you tell the coalition that you're a part of the insurgency or you're a part of some form of jihad, you're basically telling your captors that you never want to be released. You know, what in the world would possess a person to admit to so much? And I think that eventually there was a bit of an answer to that question of mine because he tried to convert me for 2 hours. When he entered the room, I was sitting, and I didn't respond to him. I didn't respond to his greeting to me, and I didn't stand to greet him. I simply motioned to the chair, and the table had already been removed from the room, so we were sitting directly across one another without any barrier. He was thin, had long fingers, and long toes, and he wore sandals like all of the others did, these flip-flop sandals. He wore a yellow jumpsuit, which was the usual attire of detainees. I asked him why he came to Iraq to kill, and then he asked me why I came to Iraq to kill. And I said, I didn't come here to kill. I came here because it's my duty, and I came here to try to prevent the killing of innocent people. You know, he'd come back and say, you're a soldier. If the U.S. had a different intention in Iraq, they would have sent different people. But the U.S. sent soldiers, which means you were sent here to kill. He asked me if I was a Christian, and I said yes. And he kind of smiled, and he told me that I was a very puzzling man, that I wasn't following the commandments of Jesus to love my enemies and to pray for those who persecute me and to turn the other cheek. He would look at me and he would say, you know, I have a certain peace because of my faith in Islam, that if I were to spend the rest of my life in prison, that would be the will of God, and I would be content to accept that as the will of God. He said, I don't think you have the same kind of peace, the same kind of faith. Not long after that, he told me that I wasn't following the commandments of Jesus to love my enemies. And at that point, that was when I knew that he'd just pulled out the ace in his deck. And nothing came out of my mouth except for silence. And I told him that I thought that he was right. I told him that, you know, the people in my life who have been my moral heroes have been prisoners, largely. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, St. Paul, Jesus, people who had been wrongly accused or been perhaps rightly accused but under unjust grounds and had been in prison. And I told him that my life would actually be more coherent from a spiritual perspective if I was in his seat, if I was the prisoner. He said he didn't believe me. And legitimately, I mean, I don't necessarily think I believe myself.
In the battle for Joshua's loyalty, service to God slays service to country. Blinking in the face of his sworn enemy, Joshua tried to draw on his faith to find common ground with the jihadi before him.
And we started talking about the cycle of vengeance and about Christianity and Islam. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, Joshua, you're the Christian who believes that the truth of humanity was made manifest in the incarnation of Jesus Christ. You're supposed to have the answers for him. What are you going to tell him? And I realized that I couldn't tell him anything because what I needed to do was to show him. I needed to be that answer. I needed to be able to say, you know what, there is an answer to the cycle of vengeance. The cycle that says you're justified to kill me and the cycle, you know, and that I'm justified to kill you. Let's both take this path together. Let's both put aside violence. But there's no way I could have possibly said that to him, you know, wearing my uniform, being in the position that I was in. He was a person not that different than me. I'd never fired a weapon in combat. I'd certainly fired weapons, but I'd never fired in combat. I was an idealistic kid who believed in my faith. And he was an idealistic kid who believed in his faith. And whether or not either of us were truly embodying our faith to its fullest, we were at an impasse of history and situation which made us each other's enemies. But once I realized that I was at the impasse that we had approached was who had the more just cause, the more I simply just, the more I gave up.
I wonder, as Joshua tells me this story, how he must have looked to this young Saudi, a man he described as his Muslim mirror.
I'm sure that I wore my heart on my sleeve over the course of the conversation, and I'm sure that he saw my anxiety. And the more that we talked about ethics, and the more that he called me on my own contradictions, the more that I certainly went into almost the voice of a supplicant. My tone of voice and my general posture in my chair, the general demeanor of my face, would have been much more soft and inquisitive than the interrogation began. I realized that I had certainly broken my objectivity as an interrogator. I was no longer exploding intelligence in the quickest amount of time, and so I terminated the interrogation, and I went to my chain of command, and I said, I've lost my objectivity with this man. If you want to get intelligence out of him, you're going to have to find somebody else to do it.
Joshua found himself alone in the chapel of Abu Ghraib, trying to find answers and a way out.
How can I continue doing this? How can I continue, having this private spiritual life that has so much to say about justice and about love, not only of God, but of one's neighbor? The week after, I decided that I would apply for conscientious objection.
And he received it, and he went home.
I should have refused interrogating people that I thought were innocent and taken the punishment myself in that situation. Pragmatically speaking, what would that have done to the individuals themselves? Because they would have found a different interrogator to do the interrogation. So perhaps, those consequences would have ensued despite my objection. But I mean, there's a double fold to violence, which is, violence is not only done to the person receiving the act of violence, but violence is done to the person who is wielding the violence.